Hello, I'm Richard Addy. This is Best Practice. If you're a manager, you want your team to be healthy, happy, and engaged. But even more importantly, you want them to be resilient, because if things aren't tough now, you know that they will be at some stage. Dr. Monique Crane is a lecturer in the Faculty of Human Sciences at Macquarie University and editor of the just-published Managing for Resilience. She says that there's a lot that managers should be doing to tackle what's a growing and costly consequence of stress in the workplace.
One of the reports from Work Safety Australia indicated that it was costing the Australian economy around $3 billion a year, and that was in 2012 to 2013. Now, looking at statistics that came from Heads Up, they're talking more around the mark of about $10.9 billion a year. And where that figure comes from is costs related to absenteeism that might be relevant to mental health issues or is relevant to mental health issues, costs related to compensation paid to employees, costs related to retraining employees who can no longer do those roles. And so there are considerable expenses related to mental health issues in the workplace, and that's not estimating also the cost associated with presenteeism.
I was going to say, what that captures is essentially when it gets to be clinical, like a proper medical problem, rather than what we know happens, where there's a lot of stress in the workplace, but people keep kind of soldiering on. They're just not at anything like full capacity.
Yeah, that's right. So people turning up to work, but not necessarily having their mind on the job necessarily. So they're present, but they're not really functioning at full capacity, like you say. And it's very hard to estimate those costs. So the costs we do have are probably not the complete picture around what it actually costs the Australian economy.
No, indeed. Is it about how an individual responds to a set of circumstances, or can we say, well, management has responsibility for this as well?
Yeah, it's a two-way street. So it's a lot of both. The individuals are, of course, responsible for their own personal resilience. We can give everyone the right resources and tools and information and all the education, but it really is about them maintaining good strategies in order to promote their own resilience. And that's where psychological resilience training at the employee level really does come in. So promoting excellent strategies and coping skills in individual employees. But again, you need them, the employees themselves, to actually maintain those strategies. But a manager also has a lot of responsibility in this space as well. And I think that's extremely heartening. So managers might feel quite overwhelmed and out of control in terms of helping their employees manage their resilience, and that's just not the case. So they have a big role to play in terms of the way work's designed, the way or the degree to which employees might have autonomy and control over their roles, the degree to which the managers themselves model good, resilient thinking and behaviour that can then trickle down to the employees. So that becomes a very important factor, actually, that modelling of resilience to employees themselves.
Now, we've spoken about resilience before, you and I, but I feel we've got to backtrack a bit and just kind of make clear what it is, because there's a lot of myths about resilience.
Yeah. So in terms of what resilience is, so if we were to define it, we often define it as bouncing back from illness and hardship. Okay. When we talk about hardship, we could be talking about everyday stresses, adversities, such as divorce, which is a significant adversity, separation from one's children, things like that. And we can also be talking about trauma. And what we think about is that sort of magnitude from low-level stresses that occur to us every day, so time pressure at work, for example, to the more spiky end of stresses like the traumatic events. And so what we're looking for there is the way people return to normal functioning after the incident of something like this. And all those factors that I've spoken about in terms of, you know, the stress and the adversity and the trauma, they are all expected to present a level of risk that where we might anticipate that if someone was exposed to that, that they might have a risk of not functioning particularly well. So people who are resilient don't necessarily experience no detriment to their functioning. They might have a small downturn in functioning, say you lose a few nights sleep. Most people have experienced that. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're not resilient. Okay, that's within the normal range. What we're talking about where are people who might experience this short-term deficit in functioning. That could be performance, the way they interact socially, sleep, but then they quickly return to normal functioning.
Resilience is, I think we tend to characterize it as rare, but it's not, is it? I mean, most of us are mostly resilient.
Yeah, that's right, Richard. So most of us are really resilient. Studies that have been conducted on major traumatic events like the 9/11 terrorist attacks have shown that something like 80% of people are actually quite resilient to even the most offensive and aversive types of trauma. So that's really interesting. But what that means, though, for managers is if you're seeing a lot of people in your workplace who are suffering significant distress, who are suffering performance deficits, then you might question, well, what's happening here? What's happening in the system? What's happening in terms of the way I'm managing or job design or the climate of the organisation right now? Because normally we would expect 80% of people to be actually quite okay.
Some of the things that you outline are really practical. There's sort of five steps. And the reason I want to talk about that now is you say when you see, the first step is noticing, and that turns out to be not as simple as you think.
So when people read this book, at the end of the book, we ask them to do a little bit of a coaching activity, and the first step is actually noticing. So noticing the degree to which your employees are actually exhibiting resilient behaviours. How do they respond to difficulties in the workplace environment? Do they look like they're bouncing back, or are we looking at significant distress of quite a few employees during those types of circumstances? The other thing is how you react. So noticing how you react to difficult circumstances. Do you become irritable, abrasive? Is there interpersonal conflict? Or are you cool and calm under pressure? And noticing the way you actually interact and model those behaviours to employees. So getting a little bit of a feel for what's happening in the organisation.
It's a deliberate act though, isn't it? Because it's very easy to become, it's human, to become accustomed to things. These things always happen. You just stop seeing them.
Yeah, and the tendency is to just plow forward with your agenda and ignore the evidence of these things emerging. And we actually want people to take a pause and look at these things, observe them, and then make a response to them.
You also talk about your next in your five steps once people are noticing, which I think is easier to say than to do, is to consider what to change. Now, how big a challenge is that?
Yeah, so I think it is an enormous challenge for managers. And the coaching protocol that we've given at the back of the book is really about the evolution of being psychologically minded. So having an understanding of the psychology of your employees, but also your own psychology and what happens for you during these periods of stress, but also developing your own personal insight. So having a deeper understanding of what it is in the workplace context that makes your employees resilient. So what do they need? Okay, and that might be will help with the formation of your goals. What are the types of challenges that we face and how might we best address them, and what are we currently doing and what aren't we currently doing that we should be? It is sort of a change in the way we think to developing our own personal insight into our own behaviour, but the behaviour of others. And that isn't easy. It's not an easy task to ask people to do.
And you point out it's not just what to change, it's how to do it and when to do it.
Yeah. And so in the book, we're giving some guides around how to approach different things. So once you've noticed some of these potential resources that you need or style that needs to be changed in terms of the way you approach employees during times of adversity or how inflexible the workplace is. So once you've noticed these things that might need to be adapted, the book hopefully gives some practical groundwork about what you might, how you might approach that and what you might do. Now, all workplaces are different, and we say, look, you really need to keep in mind the culture of your workplace. So what's the demographic? What's the culture in terms of what types of values and beliefs do people subscribe to? So something I would suggest in the military, for example, is going to look very different to something that you would suggest for the ABC or a media organisation. So you have to be mindful of the climate and the context you're working in, and then you can adapt some of the ideas in the book to that.
I guess it makes sense to ask yourself a bunch of questions. So when you're considering how to change and when to change, what are you going to do differently? I mean, that's the first question. And that immediately bumps up against something else that you really underline, which is identifying the barriers to change. In any organisation, certainly any that I've been in, as soon as somebody talks about doing something differently, somebody else will say, but. And a lot of it's because we've always done it this way, or we can't do it that way because of this thing that we already have to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And so one part of coaching when it comes to managerial leadership coaching is identifying the barriers to change, because if we don't identify them early on, we might later down the track realise we haven't changed and wondered why. And so if we're able to see what the potential barriers might be, we can start to adapt strategies to get around them. But when you're talking about barriers, Richard, you've mentioned a lot of external barriers. So you've mentioned sort of perhaps layers of bureaucracy. We've always done things the way we have, but we also suffer from internal barriers, like our assumptions about people. And one of the assumptions that we often encounter is that if, for example, if I give my employees more flexibility around childcare or time off, then they'll take advantage of that. So that's a psychological barrier that prevents us changing. And what that means is that we're not willing to engage in certain helpful behaviours or approaches, like having a more flexible arrangement that would ultimately help employees to manage some of the stuff perhaps in their personal lives that might be playing on their mind and creating stress for them, because of our impersonal assumptions about the way we perceive people's work ethic, for example.
Well, that gets us onto something that you specifically address in your chapter with Francis McMurtry, Work, Rest and Play. You really canvass the importance of breaks. What tips can you offer so that managers can ensure their staff have adequate rest and breaks?
Yeah, one thing we always find surprising is around the education piece. So educating employees on what good rest and recovery actually looks like. And so there's two pieces of information there that are really critical. And that is that people often don't realise how stressed they are at work. So when we come into work every day, we tend to perhaps feel a level of stress that goes unnoticed after a while, because we habituate to the work cues, increasing our heart rate, increasing our skin response, so our sweat response to coming into work, so the stress, the sort of sweat stress response, and our breathing rate. So we start to habituate to those things and we stop noticing them, okay? So that comes back to the noticing piece. And one of the things we like to do is actually we'll show employees an image of like a nature scene, and we'll show them that for a few minutes, and then we'll switch that off and we'll say, okay, now I want you to look at this scene, and it's their workplace. So we've taken photographs of their workplace, and we'll say, and we'll monitor their heart rate and their breathing response and their galvanic skin response, which is their sweating, and then we'll see this spike. Okay. And they'll be quite surprised at that. So they'll have forgotten how stressed work actually makes them until we sort of bring it back to their attention. So that's one thing. And we say, well, actually you're experiencing that every day, day in, day out. You know, and so you need to remember that it's important to recover from these stress experiences every day. And those daily breaks are more important than holidays. And that's another point.
That's interesting, because I think we all know the benefit of holidays.
Yeah, so breaks, holidays are definitely great, and we, you know, we wouldn't say don't take a holiday, but what the research generally finds is that about 3 weeks after getting back from your holiday, even if it was just at home, it's very relaxing, you will be experiencing the same level of stress that you had roughly when you left. So it doesn't take long for the kind of the benefits of a holiday to wear off, which is why we need those significant break periods in the evenings or whenever you can get them on the weekends in order to maintain a more sustainable work pace. Holidays are great, but you can't take them that often. So it's important that we start to invest more in that rest period. So educating employees around that, but also the style of recovery is important. So let's say that you went home and you did your taxes. Okay, so that's not a good break. A good break is something that you would find enjoyable and absorbing. So I find, and the research generally supports this, that having children is a fantastic break because you can't really think about work when you're trying to navigate a two-year-old or play with a child. It's quite absorbing. There's no opportunity there for you to really be distracted mentally by thinking about work. On the other hand, though, partners may not always be. And so what the research also finds, and what we educate people in, is this sense that sometimes when our partners also bring home their work or talk to us about their work and re-engage us in that work-related dialogue, that can actually be not good recovery.
Any final advice for managers who are seeking to support resilience in the workplace?
Yeah, I guess I think there needs to be a psychological commitment to embracing the idea that you do also have an influence over the resilience of your workforce, and that it's not just the employees themselves that have that impact on their own personal resilience. Resilience is a system, and it's influenced by everyone around us who has an impact on our lives, on the stresses that we face and on the resources that we might have or otherwise don't have. And managers play a huge role in that. And we need to accept a level of responsibility for that. And I'm a manager as well. And I always try to work in my resilience agenda into the way I manage. So part of the way I manage incorporates these ideas of good, resilient and sustainable practices for my employees.
Monique, there's a lot to discuss. We can't do all of it, but thank you for coming in today.
No worries. Thank you, Richard.
Dr. Monique Crane is in the Faculty of Human Sciences at Macquarie University and editor of Managing for Resilience, a practical guide for employee wellbeing and organisational performance. You'll find the details on the Best Practice homepage at abc.net.au/rn.